Welcome to the Radio Internet Story Exchange podcast, a 15-minute excerpt of a 58-minute RISE public affairs program. I'm your host and producer, Kelia Ramaris. Today's podcast is drawn from my December 2004 documentary, Peak Oil. The prices of crude oil and gasoline are big news these days. But do you really know what the reporters and pundits are talking about? Let's start by defining some terms. First of all, a barrel of oil is 42 gallons. When the various media report the price of a barrel of oil, you are really hearing about the futures contract price on the NYMEX, or New York Mercantile Exchange, of light, sweet, crude oil. Crude means it's not refined yet. What do we mean by light and sweet? Well, oil comes in a variety of weights, from super light to super heavy. The lighter the oil, the cheaper and easier it is to refine. The gasoline you put in your vehicle is a mix of weights that includes light oil, so when you hear about a rise in the price of a barrel of crude, you also see a rise in the price of a gallon of gasoline at the pump. By the way, home heating oil comes from a heavier grade of crude than the one that's making all the headlines these days. It's traded on a separate contract. Oil can also be sweet or sour. This refers to the sulfur content of the oil. The sweeter the oil, the less sulfur, the easier and less expensive it is to refine, and the easier it is for refiners to meet environmental regulations regarding sulfur content in petroleum products. Light oil is not necessarily sweet. For example, there's a type of oil called Arab Light, produced in Saudi Arabia, that has a high sulfur content and is therefore sour. Various weights and flavors of oil sell at different prices. Light sweet crude is the most desired type, so it commands the best price. Best if you're a seller, at any rate. In 2001, Bonnie Faulkner and I featured Professor Richard Heinberg in a Christmas edition of Guns and Butter on KPFA. At that time, Heinberg introduced me to the concept of peak oil, which was then often called the big rollover.
When about half of the oil has been extracted from a given field, it becomes more and more difficult to continue production at the same level. Typically what happens is when about half the oil has been extracted, that's when the rate of production or the rate of extraction of oil peaks, and from that point it tapers off. The big rollover is really probably going to be the most important economic event of our lifetimes. Industrial civilization is built on fossil fuels. The whole thrust of the industrial civilization has been the replacement of human and animal and wood power with the power of fossil fuels.
The price of oil, like the price of every other commodity, goes up when there's less supply than buyers want, or when future continuity of supply becomes uncertain. And there have been many supply concerns in 2004. Labor disputes in Norway and Nigeria that shut down production, political instability in Venezuela that featured a two-day coup against President Hugo Chavez, and a presidential recall election which Chavez survived. The continued military occupation of Iraq and the resultant insurgency against the occupation. Moscow's apparent intent to tax giant oil producer Yukos to death. And Hurricane Ivan, which hit oil-producing regions in the Gulf of Mexico. It took months to replace or repair the offshore drilling rigs destroyed or severely damaged by the hurricane. Physical problems are compounded by psychological problems. When the market is uncertain of supply, a so-called fear premium gets built into the price. But even if all the geopolitical, meteorological, and psychological problems were to be resolved in favor of reliable production, you still wouldn't see $20 a barrel again. That's because of peak oil, what Heinberg called the big rollover. Peak is a structural phenomenon that operates independently of how many hurricanes hit the Gulf of Mexico, how many refineries the oil companies shut down, or how many pipelines the Iraqi insurgents can bomb. Peak is the consequence of the fact that oil is a finite resource. There are the people who believe that better technology will keep peak at bay. Indeed, improved recovery techniques will enable us to get more from an oil field, though one can never recover 100% of the oil. There comes a point where it takes more money and energy to get a barrel of oil out of the ground than the barrel is worth on the market. And all oil fields do not perform equally well. Some will yield greater percentages of their total oil than others, even fields close to each other. Then there's the problem of declining oil quality as fields age. A newly developed field is under high pressure. Getting the oil out is not that difficult. But after a while, water has to be injected to provide additional pressure to lift out the oil that is deeper in the well. The water cut is the ratio of water to oil that comes to the surface. The higher the water cut, the lower the quality of your drilling results. After all, the objective is to get oil, not water. It's also possible for an oil field to be overworked, resulting in the source rock being destroyed and the field collapsing. Put the words end, age, and oil into a search engine, and you will come up with dozens of entries for books, periodicals, and even a 5-part audio series I did for the internet in 2002 that say the end of the age of oil, or something similar. That's really a misnomer. It makes people think that we are saying that the world is running out of oil. But peak of production occurs when roughly half the obtainable oil has been exploited. National Geographic's June 2004 cover story was more accurately titled. They called it The End of Cheap Oil. There's still oil being discovered. Despite the continuing discoveries, Dr. Ali Samsam Bakhtiari, a senior expert with the National Iranian Oil Company, thinks that all the really big oil fields on the planet have been discovered.
I certainly do think all the major oil fields have been found. There is no way that the oil industry has left anything behind. So it has all been found. And second, there are no more places to look for oil. We have looked everywhere. There are only two remaining. It's the North Pole and the South Pole. And these two places working there is enormously difficult, as you can imagine. And drilling into ice caps is a very, very messy business. So I don't think that man is going to go to these two extremes very soon. I hope that the oil industry doesn't go there at all, because it won't change anything.
As for the world's largest crude exporter, Saudi Arabia, the Saudis are saying that they can supply the world market with oil into the middle of the century, not only at current production rates, but at even much higher levels. But Matthew Simmons is challenging their claims. Simmons, an energy policy advisor to the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign, is founder and chairman of Simmons & Company International, an investment bank to the energy industry that's headquartered in Houston, Texas. Simmons has read over 200 technical papers on Saudi Arabian oil fields, has visited the Desert Kingdom, and has appeared on panels with representatives of Saudi Aramco, the state oil company. On the morning of September 28, 2004, the Saudis promised to increase their production to 11 million barrels a day. Later that afternoon, I asked Simmons if they could do it.
I think it's interesting today that they're so confident, with no track record, that they could do that forever when they've only briefly done it one time in the last almost 25 years.
Even if the Saudis can make good on their promise to increase production, one must ask, what kind of oil can they produce now, sweet or sour? The markets want more sweet oil. There's plenty of sour available. Will they be increasing production at the risk of ruining their wells? And will any increased production meet U.S. government expectations, which put Saudi Arabian oil production at 22 million barrels per day by the year 2025? On October 26, 2004, recently retired Saudi Aramco Vice President Sadat al-Husseini told London's Channel 4 television that U.S. estimates are too high. Quote, "They are not only overestimating the Middle East, but they overestimate non-OPEC, they overestimate Russia, they overestimate the whole global resource base. I would actually say that the probability of me living on the moon is higher odds than Saudi Arabia producing 22 million barrels a day." Unquote. So what about that rosy report the U.S. Geological Survey put out in 2000 that says that we're still a couple of decades away from peak? Colin Campbell told me in 2002 that the study's methodology, which relied on academic estimates and no actual test drilling, was faulty.
The simple way to demonstrate that the study is flawed is to say that their mean estimate of what is going to be found and produced, one assumes, in the period of 30 years from 1995 to 2025, works out on average now at 24 billion barrels a year. And the actual results, now 7 years into the study period, have been less than half this, when you would expect the larger fields to come in first. So really there is no credibility left in that study as such.
Solutions range from the international to the individual. Colin Campbell is advocating the Rimini Protocol.
The idea of the protocol is very simple, really. First of all, no country shall produce oil at above its current depletion rate. And depletion rate is annual production as a percentage of what is left. Secondly, the consumers would have to agree to cut their imports by this same world depletion rate, namely about 2.5% a year. It's not a particularly burdensome thing to ask anybody to do. So if that would happen, then world prices of oil would moderate again, simply because demand and supply would be in balance and in reasonable relationship with the actual cost of producing. That means, in turn, that the poor countries of the world could afford at least something. But most important of all, it would force the consuming countries, the importers, to recognize the reality of this depletion, and they would have to get more efficient, they would have to turn to renewables wherever they could, and above all, they would have to accept the reality imposed by nature, not by Arabs or anybody else, simply by nature, and begin to adapt to face up to what is imposed upon them anyway. Unlike the Kyoto Protocol that calls for the main offenders to agree to it, this protocol has the advantage that any country that did adopt the principles of it, quite regardless of what anybody else did, would be in fact investing in its future. It would soon be more efficient, more in balance with the situation that exists. It would be better prepared, and so it would have a natural advantage over those who simply continue to live in the past.
Matthew Simmons wants to see changes in industries and homes.
Stopping instantly, as soon as you can do this, the use of industrial electricity to melt metal and boil liquid. That's maybe two-thirds of our industrial electricity use, and industrial electricity use is one-third of our total use. And immediately put it under the burner tip, using natural gas as a heat source versus electricity, because you save 2 to 3 to 1 energy. That's a very powerful thing. It takes a long time to do.
And that's not going to be a problem with our natural gas supply?
Well, because right now what we're doing is using up our precious natural gas supply to create electricity. We need a total reexamination of air conditioning technology. That's possibly our most single inefficient household energy use today. And since almost all of America has now decided that it's just a sort of a, you know, a right to make sure you have air conditioning, we need badly a new generation of air conditioning and probably some way to price air conditioning so that when you really don't need to use it, you really pay a huge premium if you want that luxury.
Bob Gregson is going to take his ideas directly to his neighbors in Ukiah.
I intend to start a program going door-to-door probably in the spring, educating people about what peak oil and peak natural gas means to them as individuals, what they can be doing on a basis, promoting community gardens, increasing number of car co-ops, of equipment libraries, bringing in artisan trades into our community, because these are the kinds of things that we're going to need in the long term.
You've been listening to the Radio Internet Story Exchange podcast, Peak Oil, drawn from my December 2004 documentary of the same name. Since the original documentary was produced, Matthew Simmons has written the book Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy, in which he again raises serious doubts about Saudi Arabia's long-term ability to satisfy the West's thirst for oil. Professor Richard Heinberg has taken up the promotion of the oil depletion protocol developed by Dr. Colin Campbell. And Dale Allen Pfeiffer, who was not in the podcast but is in the documentary, has written a book called Eating Fossil Fuels about oil and industrial agriculture. It's due to be published in the fall of 2006. Peak oil and its consequences is one of RISE's areas of focus, so look for more podcasts and full programs on energy in the coming weeks and months. You can learn how to obtain the full 58-minute documentary Peak Oil, which includes several voices you did not hear on the podcast, by visiting the Radio Internet Story Exchange website, www.rise4news.net. That's www.rise4news.net. I'm the RISE host and producer, Kelly O'Ramaris. My email address is kellia@riseforenews.net. That's K-E-L-L-I-A at R-I-S-E, the number 4, news.net. This is the Radio Internet Story Exchange podcast. Thanks for listening.